Good morning, Your Honors. And please the court.
Good morning.
I am Nathaniel Foote. I am here for the appellant, Owen Marfia. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The appellant is here to ask this court reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment as to his negligence claims only against the appellee, the Gettysburg Area School District.
That includes your request as to negligent hiring as well as negligence, right?
Correct. General negligence, negligent hiring, negligent retention, and negligent training as well. So all the varieties of negligence that exist in the original complaint. The district court dismissed the appellant's negligence claims, and in doing so made sort of two primary categories of error that I would like to discuss. First, the district court applied the wrong law on duty, as exists in Pennsylvania, to the appellant's negligent claim, particularly his negligent hiring retention claim. And then second, the second category of error encompasses the sort of factual errors, the factual instances made against the appellant, and that is primarily in two categories. First, when the abuse of the appellant began in this case, and then what the district knew about the abuser by the time the appellant was abused. So first, let me turn to duty. More than 25 years ago, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided Hutchinson v. Luddy, which is often referred to as Hutchinson 2 in the case law. Hutchinson 2 holds that an employer has a duty not to retain an employee it knows or should know has a propensity for sexually abusing students. Critically, Hutchinson explicitly says that liability is not limited to abuse that occurs on school grounds or during school hours. I'll quote from Hutchinson. A school may be liable for the abuse of a student by a school employee outside of school hours where there is a causal connection between a particular injury and the fact of employment. And that is the key phrase from Hutchinson 2.
Let's assume that's so as to the location. What is the difference of contemporaneous knowledge of the school district that would indicate a propensity for sexual abuse of a child?
So this turns sort of to the second set of errors by the district court here. The district court, in characterizing the evidence and the testimony in the record regarding the notice about propensity or the notice about the abuser, they basically say that there's evidence he was creepy, and in hindsight, all these years later, it looks pretty bad, right? But that's really not what the record reflects. I think if we take all the inferences regarding that testimony in the appellant's favor, we have teachers who have seen enough that they have a contemporaneous belief at that time, and this is in the early 2000s prior to the appellant even starting at the school district, that they think that this teacher is sexually attracted to his male students. If we take that inference just one step further, where a jury could take it, they think this man is at least considering, if he hasn't already, abusing students.
But who specifically are you talking about when you say they?
So there are two teachers primarily who testified to a belief. And if you look at their testimony in the record, they aren't saying, I think that today. They're saying that we had a belief he was potentially sexually attracted to his students.
Roxanne Smith. The paraprofessional,
correct.
And that was 2003.
And then Miss Yingling is, I think, their teacher's name, who that would have also predated the appellant's attendance in third grade at the school district. And what that's based on is a variety of things that they've seen. Now, admittedly, did they see the teacher in a bathroom abusing a student? Of course not, and that kind of evidence almost never exists. What we see is a sort of age and gender specific interest. We see him alone or taking trips alone with the students. They know that he's spending time with students outside of school. One of the teachers testifies that she sees him straddling the students, which she finds odd enough to form this thought in her head. And then there's another teacher, and I apologize, her name escapes me at this moment, who actually did report something to administration regarding sort of the closeness that the abuser teacher would sort of have the male students at his desk.
But the only thing that was reported with that teacher was that the favoritism of students sitting close to desk being inappropriate with jokes about flatulence.
Right.
The more disturbing observations that you referenced. Where is there any evidence that that was reported to the school principal or the school leadership? And doesn't there need to be that report for the duty to be imposed on the school district?
I'm glad you asked that question, because the answer is no. The administration does not have to know, and none of the employees have to report it for the duty and potential liability to attach. And this is, you know, our papers talk a lot about this, because there is sort of a conflation, I think, of the various standards that are applied to school district cases in the Commonwealth, right? So we have Section 1983, we have Title IX, we have negligence now, because the Tort Claims Act has now allowed us to bring negligence claims for sexual abuse cases. If we are applying sort of foundational negligence principles, the district is bound by the action or inaction of any of its employees. They don't have to be appropriate persons. They do not have to be supervisory officials. They can be a paraprofessional who doesn't act on that information, and that can still bind the district. Because in a negligence case, we don't sue the individual employees of a defendant. We sue the defendant, and then we look for the negligence within the conduct of the employees, and they do not have to be supervisory. I'll give you an analogy. Let's imagine, instead of a sexual abuse case, this is a school bus accident. And the school bus driver fails to stop at the red light. Well, we don't have to then prove that supervisory officials of the school district knew that she might then run the red light. We just proved that the low-level employee, the school bus driver, was negligent in that instance. So here, the red light, or the sort of the act of negligence, the inaction of the teachers and paraprofessional, can bind the district in negligence. Now, that wouldn't work if this was a Title IX claim. There's a reason we didn't appeal the Title IX claim. And there's a suggestion, I think, in some of the arguments made by the district, and even the district court seems to sort of believe this to be the case, that, well, if there's not enough here, if we haven't proven that leadership was aware of these concerns, then the negligence claim fails too. And, you know, we haven't appealed that, and so obviously our next case is deficient as well. But my point is exactly the opposite, that we do not need to prove that anybody within administration knew.
What is your best authority under state law that attribution of knowledge of an employee gives rise to duty on the part of the entity?
So I actually would point you to a decision from last year that is cited in some of the papers. And I will give you the site here. It's BW versus Career Tech Center of Lackawanna County. It's another middle district case. I'm sorry, it's from 2024. And in that case, Judge Mannion looks at a variety of the claims that are brought in this context. It's an abuse case against a Career Tech Center school, and looks at the Tort Claims Act piece and says, well, if any of these people knew about these allegations, then that binds the district. And he also looks at Title IX and the other claims in there and says, well, that, you know, obviously doesn't work for those kinds of claims. But since the Tort Claims Act says now that we can bring simple negligence claims, and since state law allows attribution of sort of, you know, the agent's negligence is the principal's negligence, then that's enough if we have knowledge among the staff. And that's based on a variety of cases. I mean, there are cases in addition from this court on that point. I mean, Crowell v. City of Philadelphia is a good example of the Tort Claims Act discussing negligence and what negligence can be imputed sort of up the chain.
But we're not talking about a negligent act being imputed to the employer. We're talking about knowledge giving rise to the duty, right?
Right, of course. So but that knowledge then leads to either action or inaction. So it's really the inaction of the low-level employees who have this knowledge in their head and then do nothing with it to protect students. And where does that obligation come from? Like, what obligation do they then have to act? I mean, they're, you know, this is a reason why this is a case for a jury and not for a judge to decide on summary judgment, because, you know, obviously there would be presentation of evidence regarding what the standard is. What does an educator do in 2003 with that information in their head? And, you know, it wasn't discussed by the district court in the opinion. You know, we have expert testimony on that point. It would certainly argue that there's a variety of sources of that obligation. That there's, you know, when that information is in the head of an educator, even if it's just a paraprofessional, they have to tell somebody. They have to report it either up the chain or to law enforcement or do something. And one could imagine a series of counterfactuals where when that information is reported in, let's say, 2003, 2004, 2005, at any point prior to the appellant becoming a student, something happens that stops the chain of events that then starts sort of in 2009 and continues.
Could you talk a little bit about proximate cause, and specifically about the stepmother permitting Marfio, when he was a child, to spend so much time and spend those nights over at the house, and even letting that continue after suspicion of inappropriate behavior?
I think the way for the court to deal with that, or particularly the way for the appellee to deal with that, would be to actually add her as a defendant. They did not do that here. That is often the way that plays out when you have essentially a negligent parent. And I'm not going to say the parent defend any of the appellant's family here. But that does not defeat the case against the district. It just means that you have to do the sort of the substantial factor analysis that you would do in any negligence case regarding causation. So you'd say, well, okay, the stepmother, was she a factor? Of course. With Adams County CYS, who was additionally a defendant at one point in this case, did they play a role here? Yes. But obviously, there can be multiple defendants that lead to a single tort in any negligence case. And so, you know, we can't say simply because he came from a difficult family background and had too little supervision that alleviates the obligation for the school district.
I think ultimately, the way it comes down to, like, even if the school district was negligent in hiring, maintaining him as an employee and supervising him and all those things, is the stepmother's conduct so extraordinary that it really put it ended the causal chain, such that it was her actions that led to this abuse, really not the school district's.
Well, again, I think if we take all the factual inferences in the appellant's favor, as we should, ultimately she actually does try to stop the relationship between these two. So if you look at that fact coupled later on she becomes concerned about the behavior. So now we can assume a factual scenario where if the school district gets involved and says, hey, the behavior of this teacher is inappropriate years before, you know, that could have triggered that same reaction then. But I think, you know, what you would hear her say is that by that point, it's years after this, right? So now we're in like 2012. She starts to sort of try to slow this relationship down. But now this man has become so ingrained in the family's life and has sort of gone far enough down the road of developing the relationship with the appellant that she can't stop it, is basically what she would say. But again, that sort of is assuming facts that, you know, I don't think we can assume at this point. I don't think we can assume that, you know, because basically it comes from a bad family, that it's factually impossible that a good actor in this story stops this abuse.
Well, but much of the abuse, I thought it was understood and contested that the abuse started after the period of time when Owen Marfio was a student in the district.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because that is a contested fact. And in fact, I think it's sort of one of the easiest bases for this court to overturn the district court opinion, because the record is, in the appellant's opinion, clear the abuse started prior to his departure from the district.
But you don't argue in your brief. You say that they, you know, it was fomented, it was developed, you know, and then it really started later. So I mean, my understanding from the appellate brief is that you're saying that they kindled this, and then it really exploded after Mr. Murphy was no longer a student.
With respect, I'm pretty sure we did argue that the abuse started prior to him leaving the school, because I remember this very clearly. We are arguing that the abuse started before him leaving. Whether the appellant sort of understood that or not, I mean, he's a third grader. So what he understands is happening at that time, he may have not articulated it in his testimony of abuse, but what's happening is he's sleeping in bed with an unrelated man. That man is bathing him. He sort of, you know, we believe, sort of fakes touching his pants, and sort of makes up an excuse for touching him. And the district court itself writes in its opinion that there's no, quote, other sexual contact beyond what I've just described while he's still a student. But no other sexual contact presumes there is some sexual contact. And so I think we've argued throughout, both at the district court level and in our papers here, that we absolutely contend that the sexual abuse started while he's a student at the Gettysburg Area School District before this abusing.
But you argue that in the brief, but you didn't dispute that in the statement of undisputed material facts when the district said that it started after.
I think that if we didn't dispute it, it was simply because the appellant, from the appellant's perspective at the time when he testified, he said it started after, and that is true. So when he testified, he said, yeah, the abuse in his mind started later, because he did say that, because in his mind, you can imagine, I mean, what's happening to him is essentially so minor compared to how it ramps up post his removal from the Gettysburg Area School District. But
aren't we bound by that record?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Aren't we bound by that record?
Well, I think you can look at the testimony regarding what was happening, even if the appellant said, no, he didn't start abusing me until after he took me out of the school district. But also, let me tell you about what was happening in my third grade year. Well, that record is in front of you. Because I know in the record, he describes, you know, the bathing, the sleeping, and the touching that happens while he's still in the third grade. Even if he then says, yeah, then he starts abusing me, because, and I'll spare the room graphic details, but what is really the abuse in his mind, sort of as the person experiencing it, is when these sexual acts become overtly, like, and clearly sexual acts. And that happens when he leaves. But you know, any adult reading that who didn't experience it looks at that and goes, wait, an unrelated adult man is doing what to his third grade student? I mean, clearly, in my mind, it's obvious abuse.
Take a few minutes to talk to us about the negligent hiring claim.
I have about 9 seconds left, but I'm happy to answer.
So the floor is open.
So the negligent hiring claim, and I started talking about Hutchinson because I think it's really important for this court to define sort of what the standard is for negligent hiring and retention. And they're often talked about sort of overlapping. And what I'm focused on here is retention, because the notice information I talked about comes after he's hired in the mid-1990s. So this is the early 2000s. And that negligent retention claim is defined by the sort of the same standard from Hutchinson too, which is still good law and has been cited by this court several times, including very recently last year. And Hutchinson it's important to note that there's sort of a distinction within it. So there's section 317 of the restatement, which it talks about, which has sort of those elements, including that sort of like situs element. And you know, 317 says it has to be on the employer's premises or with chattels of the employer. But the way Hutchinson deals with that is basically it makes it relational rather than like it has to be in a piece of property owned by a school district or a church. It looks at the relationship between the priest in Hudson and the victim in Hutchinson and says, well, this abuse is happening in a location that he has access to by virtue of the trust placed in him by the church.
Let me just clarify your claim as to what I thought was hiring, in that you were taking issue with the extent of the background check with the prior employer, with CYS, right, by the school district. Is that not the basis for a negligent hiring claim?
No, we believe that's also the basis of a negligence claim. However, just since we've been discussing the amount of notice at the school, I just wanted to focus on the retention piece. But it's all related, and certainly, you know, if this case is remanded, we try to prove each of those negligence claims through different evidence. So we have, you know, there's no insufficient reference and background check done based on what we believe is termination from CYS. Then he gets to the school, and now it's a retention issue because now we've got issues at the school that we'll see. And then, and then there's separately the training issue, which is the district paraprofessionals and teachers don't know what to do with this information because they're not fully trained. It's all part of it's all part of our case in chief on the negligence claims.
Are you referring to the negligent retent claim as a standalone claim that is being appealed now?
So the negligent hiring and retention are basically discussed in the same breath in Hutchinson. So Hutchinson is the, sort of the standard for negligent hiring. And courts in all negligence cases tend to sort of conflate all these terms together. But Hutchinson is the standard for basically a duty. The way the restatement calls it is sort of the duty of the master to control the servant. And that restatement section sort of can encompass negligent hiring, negligent retention, or sort of any of those related negligence theories, however you term them. But really it's what is the duty? Where do we get the duty? We get the duty from Hutchinson and from section 317 of the restatement. And one point I wanted to make about Hutchinson too is it's not just based on section 317. And the court actually takes pains to say, you know, the lower court only based the duty of the diocese in that case on Section 317. Actually, if you look back at like Coth v. Jones, it's broader than that in this state. So 317 is sort of one version of that duty, but it comes really from like Coth v. Jones, in which an employee sexually assaulted a woman at her home. But again, they focus on causal connection between the master-servant relationship. So does he have access to that woman because of his employment? My time is up.
We'll hear from you in rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Thomas Specht. I'm here from Marshall Dennehy, and I represent Gettysburg School District, and we request that this court affirm the district court. A couple of points that I'd like to address with regard to what the appellant's counsel stated. With regard to the failure to appeal the Title IX, he makes much of the fact in his plot brief that we're saying that because he didn't appeal Title IX that he can't have a negligence claim, and it's really not what we're saying. Our argument is a little more nuanced than that, in that there were certain factual findings made by the district court with regard to Title IX that have not been appealed, such as that an appropriate person at GASD was no appropriate person was aware that plaintiff was being sexually harassed or abused by Mr. Marfia. And also that the testimony regarding observations of, you know, straddling, being too close to the students in his classroom, or things like going on school trips with, you know, other adults present, those type of matters, the district court held with regard to Title IX that these did not constitute sufficient evidence of sexual abuse or harassment, or evidence that plaintiff was a danger to sexually abused students. And we argue that by not appealing those determinations, that it makes it very difficult in our mind to see how negligent hiring could be established. No appropriate person at GAS, at the school district, had knowledge that Mr. Murphy was a danger to sexually abused students. How could they be said to have knowledge that he had a propensity to sexually abuse students?
I'm not sure I follow. This isn't it's not a bench trial verdict that we're reviewing. It's a summary judgment decision. So appealing that is the question before us, whether there is sufficient evidence for a jury to make determinations like the ones you just identified.
Well, that is the issue, Your Honor. That is the issue, whether or not there is sufficient evidence. But those determinations were not appealed, and we would argue are now the law of the case through the Title IX. So they should have some effect on the view of the facts in that, like I said, the district court did determine that there was no evidence that any decision maker at the school district had any knowledge of any sexual abuse or any propensity for sexual abuse.
Do you agree with your colleague that under Pennsylvania law, in a negligence case, that the knowledge of any employee is attributed to the employer?
I don't agree that it's attributable to the employer, and I would say that what that would have relevance to, what the knowledge of an employee would have relevance to, and would be with regard to the negligent training, in that if they had knowledge of sexual abuse and didn't report it, then that could possibly be held against the school district if you were determined that there was negligent training on the part of the school district. If they didn't report for some other reason, not having anything to do with negligent training, then that could not be held against the school district. And what they need to possess here is they have to have reasonable cause to suspect that a child is a victim of child abuse. And that's pursuant to statute, that's pursuant to 23 PACS section 6311A4. And there is no evidence of that in this case whatsoever, even with the persons that were referred to by counsel, the Miss Yingling, the Miss Smith. All that they testified to was basically speculation, their speculative beliefs about this person. And none of it was anything concrete. As a matter of fact, plaintiff's stepmother admits that there is nothing concrete that was possessed by the school district. Plaintiff admits that looking at, you know, plaintiff Murphy's behavior towards me, the school district would have had no inkling that anything inappropriate was going on. And the same thing with Ms. Smith and Ms. Yingling. Ms. Yingling, I think, testified that she didn't know whether or not he was attracted to students. I think that's her testimony. So that doesn't really have any evidentiary value whatsoever. And Ms. Smith had suspicions, was, you know, didn't really know that type of thing. This is all speculation that is insufficient to support that these employees had knowledge that a reasonable cause to suspect that a child was a victim of sexual abuse.
Isn't the issue that their observations? It's the observations that give rise to those suspicions.
Well, Your Honor, they did make observations, but these observations were just a vague, amorphous behavior that, again, is not sufficient to establish that, you know, Plaintiff Murphy was abusing anyone, and no one ever complained that he was abusing anyone. No teacher ever complained. No student ever complained. No staff at the school ever complained.
Well, there was one reporter.
You're right. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Who complained
there.
Three times? Yeah, right?
Regarding the flatulence and that type of thing. But none of that is sexual abuse, and none of that is anything that should have been reported, you know, to Childline or to any place like that. So, again, even if there was supposedly negligent training, or if there's a question of fact as to whether or not there was negligent training, which we don't agree with, they shouldn't have reported this behavior. Like, there was no legal obligation to report this behavior pursuant to the statute and pursuant to what the facts show.
What about the observation of Murphy driving the brother from school and then back to school in the morning?
Well, there, and we cite appendix sites for this in our brief, Ron. I don't have them with me right here, but that was with the teachers at the school, and the persons at the school had knowledge that there was a close relationship between the Murphy family and the Marion family, and this was being done with the stepmother's acquiescence and permission, just like, you know, the other things like attending teacher parent conferences for the plaintiff and that sort of thing by Mr. Murphy. This was all done with the acquiescence of the stepmother, and that was knowledge possessed by teachers at the district. So that, I don't think that anything like that should be held against the district with regard to any failure to report that type of behavior either. You know, with regard to, I think counsel had mentioned the fact that the timing of the abuse, we would argue that no abuse was committed during the time that plaintiff was a student at the school. There was the instance where he supposedly brushed against the pants of the plaintiff, and this was talked about with plaintiff's mother, talked about with her sister, and I guess what the record shows is that it was all viewed as an accident at the time. So in 2020 hindsight, maybe that was abuse, but at the time, not to any reasonable person would that ever be viewed as abuse. And furthermore, the school district had no knowledge of that incident. The bathing, again, the school district had no knowledge of bathing at Mr. Murphy's home, where a plaintiff was living with the permission of the stepmother. So again, regardless of any timing of any abuse, the school district had no knowledge of any of those incidents. So again, it can't be held against the school district. With regard to, I think those are most of the issues that I wish to address. If this court has,
let's talk about the hiring.
Sure.
And the allegation that that the school district didn't fulfill its duty to check with a prior employer at CYS, and had they done so, they might have uncovered the kind of information that the private investigator ended up uncovering.
Again, Your Honor, that is speculation, as the district court correctly determined. There was this information that was uncovered by the investigator for the stepmother. There is no evidence that that would have been reported to the school district if they had inquired, because in fact, what the record shows in this case is that after that investigator found out that information, the CYS actually approved the adoption of plaintiff by his abuser, and that was subsequently ratified by a court of common pleas of Adams County. So it's really, really engaging in speculation to suggest that that information would have been disclosed to the school district if they had inquired, which they had really no reason to, since plaintiff had all his certifications, state police certifications, criminal abuse, child abuse certifications from the state.
Wouldn't it constitute negligence if the school district didn't even contact the CYS?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because again, he had all his certifications, which is what the school districts rely upon. You know, they're doing criminal history checks. I'm not sure what is exactly contained on the child abuse certification, but I would think would be instances of child abuse or suspected child abuse. So I don't believe that they had any reason to inquire. There were no complaints about plaintiff that would have showed that, you know, he had a propensity to sexually abuse children, you know, that they were aware at the time, and he had a clean, you know, employment record. So I don't, again, it would seem to...
Shouldn't it be a routine check that is made on employment with the prior organizations with which the prospective employee has been in contact? Shouldn't that be a routine check?
Your Honor, I don't think that it should be. I think if they had some reason to suspect, you know, something, if they had been hearing from people, you know, that, you know, around that may have known him, that there were some problems with his prior employer. But I think if his clearances are coming back free and clear, his child abuse clearance, his state police clearance, I think that's really, you know, it's putting a burden on the school district, you know, that's unwarranted, you know.
Well, the testimony in the record is that that was the standard practice of the school district, and the deponent couldn't recall whether that took place or not.
Again, Your Honor, even if there was the standard practice, there is no evidence that that would have been disclosed to the school district and that it would have made any difference, considering, like I said, the CYS approved the adoption of plaintiff by Mr. Marfia after that date, and after that information came to light.
But at summary judgment, we're supposed to draw all the inferences in favor of the non-moving party. Right?
I agree, Your Honor. But I don't think that this court is permitted to credit speculation or credit unwarranted inferences. They could have easily deposed someone from CYS and said, if the school district had called you, would you have told them this information? And they did not. So the record is silent on that issue, and that's their burden, not ours. So right now what we have is speculation as to what CYS would have done, and that's not enough to overturn summary judgment. That's really all I have, Your Honors. We would request again that this be affirmed. We don't think that there is sufficient evidence supporting that we were negligent in any way. This is really a question of what would you have expected the district to do in this case? And, you know, we request that the summary judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Judge Roth, any further questions?
No further questions, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just wanted to address one point that the appellee raised, which regarding reasonable cause to suspect under the Child Protective Services law. So I want to be clear that there is often, we have a choice to bring a negligence per se claim for violation of Child Protective Services law, which then means we have to prove that people violated the Child Protective Services law. Where we do not do that, the Child Protective Services law can inform the standard, but it does not set the standard. So the standard with regard to what teachers should have done is instead based on sort of what a responsible educator should have done at that time in that circumstance. And that's where we have to look to, you know, expert testimony, which both sides have in this case. And the district court never discusses it, as I think I've mentioned, but, you know, we have an expert who was deposed and would testify at trial, essentially what that standard was at that time. Does the Child Protective Services law inform it? Of course. But it does not mean we have to prove a violation of the Child Protective Services law to win our negligence case. And as the district basically just said, that it's certainly relevant for whether these people were trained adequately. And I also wanted to remind the court, in the appendix, I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly where, but in the record, there is testimony from an administrator who says, well, at the time, you know, we weren't doing this kind of training, but yeah, it probably would help. It probably would prevent this kind of thing. And certainly, you know, today, you know, we do it differently, but this was, you know, 2003. The experts, I'm sure they would disagree about this, but our expert would say, well, by that point, the sort of in the industry, sort of the in the educational field, we knew plenty about the risk of abuse for you to have done more than you were doing at the time. So, again, taking all inferences in the appellant's favor, we have more than enough for you, the court, to remand this back to the district court for trial on the appellant's negligence claims. Thank you.
Judge Roth, any questions?
No questions, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank both counsel for their helpful argument this morning, and and we will take a short break and resume at 11:40.